Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sands.
We're protesting no jobs for war.
Today, we'll take you to a protest at a UIC job fair. And we'll hear about a proposed new nuclear power plant in Illinois. And we'll hear from a woman who was living in Belarus near the Chernobyl plant at the time of the meltdown that took place 19 years ago this month. We'll also speak with the host of a popular police watchdog radio program called Bad Cop, No Donut. That and more coming up. For independent news and information from Chicago and around the world, visit our internet address at www.chicago.indymedia.org. Last Tuesday, about 350 people crowded into Clinton Junior High School for a little publicized public hearing on a proposed new nuclear power plant to be built a few miles east of the town that lies in central Illinois, straight south of Bloomington. Dave Kraft, executive director of the Evanston-based Nuclear Energy Information Service, attended the hearing. He says if energy giant Exelon is allowed to push through their proposal, they will not only be on their way to building another nuclear power plant in Illinois, but they will jumpstart a whole nuclear industry.
We kind of look at this newest Exelon venture as return of the vampires, because they're going to be sucking at your wallet anytime soon.
What do you mean by this project will suck people's wallets dry?
Well, the nuclear industry is counting heavily on its friends in the Bush-Cheney administration and in Congress to authorize legislation which would guarantee all kinds of construction loans at taxpayer expenses. Whether these people who are taxpayers would ever get a single electron from any nuclear plant is totally irrelevant. So once again, you have this already mature industry taking advantage of the public trough to build the next generation of reactors, essentially.
Don't we also subsidize other sources of energy like coal and natural gas? Don't we subsidize those also? I mean, people can just say, well, we subsidize all these. Why should we separate nuclear plants from that subsidy?
Yeah, there are a lot of energy. Almost all the energy resources do get some sort of subsidization. But the so-called mature industries are the ones that scream the loudest about free market competition, get government off of our backs, and blah, blah, blah. And nuclear is one of those. It's an industry that's 55, 60 years old, certainly as old as the coal industry, you know. And these are folks who are free marketeers until it's time to pick up the tab, and then they're willing to transfer it to the public. The second piece of that, though, is if the public has to pay for something, they might as well get the maximal amount of benefit. And this is an industry that not only is inefficient, expensive, and dangerous as an energy resource, it carries the added weight of increasing the opportunity for nuclear terrorism and nuclear proliferation, both at home and worldwide. You don't have that kind of liability with renewable energy resources or conservation. So just from the hierarchy of what's preferable, if you're going to subsidize anyone, subsidize an energy industry that doesn't have such terrible deficits.
Now, it's my understanding that this permit has already been awarded for Clinton?
No. This is the very first stage of the licensing process, the formal licensing process. It's called the Early Site Permit. Essentially, what it allows Exelon and other utilities to do is plow through in a very generic, perfunctory kind of way the paperwork that would give them the formal okay to use a particular site. And the site they chose in this case is the Clinton Nuclear Reactor near Bloomington Normal in downstate Illinois. And the reason they picked it is because there was another reactor that was supposed to be built there but never was because it was too expensive. So they have the real estate. They already have a lot of the clearances okay from the first go-around with nuclear power, and they want to make this a quick and fast deal so that they can move on to the next phases of licensing, which will take place in the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Why is this happening now, though, if it hasn't happened in the last 20 years? Why is it happening now? Does it have anything to do with the energy bill that's going through the Congress?
This is make-or-break time for Exelon and the rest of the nuclear folks. They have all of their stars aligned properly. They own the White House. They own the Congress. They own the Department of Energy. It also comes at a time when the public is being rattled by warnings of global warming and all kinds of other, you know, nuclear mayhem around the planet. So if they don't get the job done now, if they don't force nuclear down our throats now, it can only get worse for them later on. So they're pulling out all the stops.
Is this also happening on a national level, that permits are being applied for or being preliminarily awarded?
Yes, there are two other sites under consideration by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. One is in Virginia by the Dominion utility there, and another one is down in Mississippi. So these are early site permits. Again, it's putting the site in a land bank, so to speak, for later selection for a nuclear reactor. You'll see more of that, though, going on if these three, or any of these three, get the go-ahead.
Do you know what kind of plant they plan to build?
The NRC has licensed a list of different designs which have not been commercially built yet, but which they've looked through some of the prototypes and given the okay. So Exelon and the other utilities can select from this list of approved designs. There may be other designs that are added to the list at a later date, but any of those would be eligible theoretically to go at this site. Currently, in the early site permit process, Exelon named two different reactor designs, one by Westinghouse, one by General Electric, that they might consider using at the Clinton site should they decide to build there.
Do you know how, if those are especially safe, or if, you know, how they rate those two designs?
Well, the industry likes to talk about so-called inherently safe reactors, or the next generation of reactors, which are inherently safe. It's kind of a chuckle because, first of all, it implies that perhaps the previous generation wasn't inherently safe, and it certainly isn't. There's nothing inherently safe about storing 1,000 Hiroshima's worth of radiation in a building, no matter how well reinforced it is. These new designs, many of them, have their own unique design features which are positive, but also have unique design features which are negative. There was one reactor design that Exelon was a part of which relied heavily on the use of graphite. They claimed it was an inherently safe reactor, but as people might recall, graphite was the big problem at the Chernobyl explosion 19 years ago. It burns, and it distributed the radioactive core around the world. So every reactor design will have its own set of flaws and idiosyncrasies. None of these new ones have been built and have a real operational history, kind of like the proof will be in the pudding when they get around to it.
Is this one of those smaller nuclear plants that at least I believe it was Dick Cheney was talking about being part of the new nuclear renaissance?
Actually, the reactor I mentioned a moment ago with the graphite, was called a pebble bed reactor, is a very small modular design, roughly one-tenth the size of your standard reactor today. But the ones that Exelon described in its early site permit in Clinton were the full-blown folks. They were about 1,000 megawatts, which is about the size of what you have at Braidwood and Byron and what you used to have at Zion already. So these are very large reactors that they're looking at putting at this site.
Mm-hmm. Now, this public hearing comes the same month that an article came out in the Chicago Tribune about Exelon having no plans to change its storage of nuclear waste, despite the National Academy of Sciences saying that the way it's being stored right now is not safe. I'd like to hear your comment about that article, about just juxtaposing that with the possibility of this new plant also having unsafe waste being stored on the property.
Mm-hmm. The article you're referring to in the Chicago Tribune was written by Robert Maynor a couple of weeks ago. We actually spoke with him about that and had a op-ed appear in the Tribune after it appeared. It's interesting, just as I said before, that these nuclear executives are free marketeers until it comes to picking up the tab, and then they want someone else to do it. They also talk about the best sound science in the National Academy until the National Academy disagrees with them, and then it's a matter of disagreeing professionals. Well, the Academy of Sciences had a very scathing report that came out stating that some of the reactors in operation, many of them in Illinois, have a very, very vulnerable reactor design in which the spent fuel pools, where the old, hot, irradiated fuel coming out of the reactors is literally stored above ground. This is extremely vulnerable in incidences where you would have a terrorist attack or, God forbid, an accidental airline, or maybe not accidental after 911, an airliner crashing into this structure. It's not in the hugely reinforced containment building that they always boast about. It's in a building that roughly has 18 inches of reinforced concrete and the roof, which is roughly a glorified Sam's Club when you analyze it. This is housing the entire 30-year reactor inventory of the reactors at Dresden, the two reactors at Quad Cities, and it's a slightly different design, but even the reactor down at Clinton and the two reactors at LaSalle. These are all vulnerable to this particular kind of problem. If those spent fuel pools are hit, let's say by an airliner or by terrorists, the water can and would drain away, could result in an intensely hot fire, which would distribute these millions of curies of radioactive materials around the countryside. That's what the National Academy was complaining about. They made some very specific recommendations. They severely criticized the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for its excessive secrecy and inability to get the information they need to further examine the safety and vulnerability of the plants. So we have a situation where our nation's best scientists and credentialed people are criticizing the industry, and the industry just brushes it off. And that's where Chairman John Rowe says, well, we have no plans to do anything at our reactors at this point in terms of making it safer for the radioactive waste to be there. Yet at the same time, now they want to add to Illinois' radioactive waste inventory by perhaps building new reactors. For us, this makes absolutely no sense at all. It's like building the John Hancock building without bathrooms and then saying, you know, we don't even need porta-potties outside. So we think the industry is way out of line on this one, and perhaps Congress will have to intervene to order them to make the changes to safeguard Illinois, which also, folks should know, has the world's busiest airport within 25 flying minutes of every reactor that we're talking about.
Now, the article says that the reason why they don't use dry flasks to put this waste material into, it doesn't have anything to do with money, but they don't say what it has to do with. What do
That's
you
correct.
Think it has to do with?
Right. There was a mention also that Exelon tries to minimize the exposure to its workers, and every time you move the fuel, you're exposing your workers. Well, the fact of the matter is they have to do it anyway when they take the fuel out of the reactor and put it in the spent fuel pool, and they will have to do it again at a time when the materials have to be moved off-site. It's better, many people believe, to put it in dry casks and distribute that inventory, so it's much harder to have a catastrophic type of accident. And you can actually do this in ways that still minimize your worker exposure. That was the only reason that was given publicly by Exelon to this point is their resistance to dry cask storage, even though they have already begun to do it at Dresden and at Quad Cities.
They're using dry casks there.
They're using dry casks there, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So what it is, I think, really is more of a public relations thing of not wanting to get the public stirred up that maybe there is a problem here that they seriously have to deal with at a time when they're trying to also persuade the public that it's a good time to have the next generation of nuclear power here in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the dry cast storage method?
It's a lesser of evil choices. We've had opposition to it in the past for a variety of reasons, and that was based on the fact that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was very incompetent in licensing the designs of some of the ones that are being used today. They actually violated their own regulations twice in getting some of these casks built even before they had authorized the design. This resulted in a couple of accidents on the Great Lakes, one in Michigan and one in Wisconsin. So from a historic standpoint, we weren't too thrilled with the concept. But after 9-1-1 and based on the extreme vulnerabilities of the wet pools at Quad Cities, at the two at Dresden, and also down in LaSalle and in Clinton, we feel that moving to dry casks improves the safety margin at the site, but not just building the casks and putting them out there. There's a much more enhanced version of this kind of storage that we have nicknamed HOSS, H-O-S-S. It stands for Hardened On-Site Storage, which would not only distribute the casks, but it would site them in the wells of bermed piles of soil or whatever, so you wouldn't get a good direct line of sight attack by a shoulder-held missile or a truck bomb or something like that. It's a much more elaborate type of storage, but it's one that we think, coupled with the dry casks, gives Illinois a much greater degree of safety and less vulnerability to terrorist attack.
Given a worst-case scenario, like if one of these storage facilities were to explode, how far would the destruction spread?
It's hard to specifically say what would happen or what wouldn't happen because there are so many variables. Even with a reactor accident, everything from the weather and the time of day down to the amount of spent fuel you're talking about. If we're talking about the spent fuel pool, there have been some analyses already done. One was done by Jan Baye, which said that the damage could be hundreds of billions of dollars and contaminate, you know, hundreds of square miles with radioactive debris from a spent fuel pool. Physicians for Social Responsibility has put together computer models, and the Chicago chapter has shown some of these computer models of spent fuel pool accidents. And we've actually seen the plumes go as far away as Indiana from the Braidwood plant, for example. And depending on which other reactors are involved and what direction the wind is blowing, could go as much as 100 miles away. So you're talking about a pretty significant piece of real estate, and not all real estate is made equal, that's for sure. We have to bear in mind that Illinois is primarily an agricultural state, too. So anytime you're talking about a radioactive accident in an agricultural region, you're essentially subjecting Illinois to what Belarus is going through after the Chernobyl accident of 19 years ago. To this date, a lot of their produce is still contaminated and not allowed on European markets. It would just simply be devastating for an agricultural state like Illinois to endure almost any kind of a nuclear accident. If you're talking about dry casks, since you have less fuel in each of the casks, that reduces the amount of potential for spreading more material. So that's why we at this point are saying it's a lesser of evil choice, but it does give you a little bit more of an advantage to contain the accident in a smaller area.
If there's anything you'd like to add, please do so, but that's all my questions.
Well, I think, you know, folks here in Illinois, we encounter people who don't even understand how nuclear reliant the state is. And we are now moving to this so-called nuclear renaissance, you used the term a moment ago, that the industry wants. It was a bad idea the first time around. It hasn't gotten any better the second time around. In fact, it's even gotten worse because the industry expects so much more from the public, both in terms of secrecy, in terms of more money, and in terms of fewer benefits and safeguards, as well as public input. We want the people of Illinois to get aroused by this. We want them to get Governor Blagojevich and the whole state apparatus opposing any new licensing of reactors. And the final reason for this is that any new reactors licensed will doom far into the future any ability to get renewable energy resources established. They simply take too much of a market share out to make renewables cost effective. So if people are out there wanting renewable resources, they had better make sure that the nuclear industry gets defeated early on before they get a chance to build a new reactor.
Mm-hmm. And the state has the power to stop this licensing?
The state will have opportunities to intervene, and they also have laws at the local level that the utilities would have to comply with. There may also be some new laws that need to be enacted which would require certain kinds of safeguards, which the federal government would have no authority over. These are the kinds of dialogues and creative mechanisms that we want Governor Blagojevich and the state legislators to work with the environmental community on to make sure that we're not bulldozed by the federal bullies of the large energy consortiums that are going on out there now.
That was Dave Kraft, Executive Director of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, found on the web at www.neis.org. As Kraft mentioned, Belarus still suffers from the meltdown that happened 19 years ago this month at the Chernobyl nuclear plant. Last fall, at the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference held in Chicago, Natalie Kilich, who grew up in a small town in Belarus near the Chernobyl nuclear plant, spoke with me about how the accident there changed her life.
I was born and grew up in Belarus, about the small town called Zloye. It's about 40 miles away from Chernobyl up north. And in April 1986, I was 10 years old when this whole thing happened. And it was spring like any other spring. It was a beautiful time of the year. The cherry orchards were blossoming. It was beautiful, except one thing. Something else was different. Something would change our lives forever. And it was the Chernobyl nuclear power plant has exploded. A week later, after April 26, 1986, my mother came home from work. We sat at the table, four of us, my sister, my parents, and I. And my mother told us that something tragic has happened, that nuclear power plant Chernobyl has exploded. And my father did not believe her. He said, how could it be? No TV station, no radio station, not even our local authority has announced anything yet. Has been one week already. He said, you must have had some kind of wrong information. It cannot be. But sure enough, there it was. A week later, our authorities, local authorities, asked the school to evacuate the children. So basically, class by class, we were evacuated and sent to the summer camps near Russia. Near the Moscow, there is a town called Zagorsk. That's where my class has been sent to. So we were separated from our parents, from our sisters and brothers, and just with our school teacher, we were sent to the summer camps where we spent 3 months. There was nobody around us. There was nobody with us who could explain why we were moved away or why we were taken away from our parents and sent away. And these 3 months, we were basically unaware of what's going on. We did not know that the Chernobyl nuclear power plant has blown up. Later on, we were grown-ups explained that the nuclear power plant blew up, and the reason that we're here because they didn't want us to be at that time around the nuclear power plant. However, 3 months later, we came back home. And we were told to live our normal lives like we always did. Nothing much has changed in our lives. We had played in the same sand, we drank the same water, we ate the same food, except one thing. We had almost monthly checkups, medical checkups in the school. And the main focus of these medical checkups was on thyroid. 30 of my classmates, including myself, had the thyroid problems. Four of us had to be hospitalized before we reached age 17. One of them did not survive. And here I am, basically 18 years later. I'm facing a problem, fundamental problem of the humankind, if I may say so. I'm facing a problem, facing the choice. If I can be or cannot be a mother. This fundamental right has been basically taken away from me. And there is nobody to hold responsible for it. There is nobody who can answer my question why I right at this point I have to make a choice. And it is something unfair that should not have happened. Because looking at my classmates, looking at my friends who stayed back home and who made that choice to be a mother or to be a father, going through a very, very difficult time right now. Lots of their children going through the medical problems.
What kind of medical problems?
Some of them have leukemia. Some of them have very weak immune system. Some of the children have cancers. And some of them children were born with disabilities. And it's all ongoing on life. That's what's going on right now at this point.
You keep track of about how many people?
I don't have exactly scientific data. I wouldn't be able to give you exactly the numbers, but that's my personal experience. That's what I've seen with my friends or with my relatives. And most of the, even sometimes they don't have a pronounced symptoms of leukemia or pronounced symptoms of cancer, but most of the kids have very weak immune system. Every time they have infections, which it's difficult for them to come out of the, let's say if they have a cold or they have an ear infection, it takes them much longer, much more time to come out from it.
What about your immediate family?
Well, my sister is here. I brought her here, and she was having a very difficult time too herself. She was 3 years old. I was 10 when this thing happened, and she got affected much more than I did. Her immune system was much weaker than mine, and even now she catches cold more often than I do, and she has a heart problem sometimes. She has a heart problem, and I don't.
Is your immediate family still surviving?
My parents are still living back there, and my cousin, she's also back there, and she has two kids. Thanks God they are okay, and they're fine. One is 9, one is 8. However, as I told you before, the immune system is very, very weak. Every winter, they go through the same thing. They catch cold. Sometimes they stay 2-3 weeks home. The same thing goes in the springtime. I wouldn't say that because of the malnutrition. They are a well-to-do family. They have vegetables. They have fruits, but local grown. Mm-hmm. So they come from the same soil, from the same water.
I was going to ask you about that. Have any tests been done on the soil and the plants around your home?
Around my particular home?
Around the area where you lived?
Around the area where I lived, the tests were done in the first, I believe, in the first 5 years, there was lots of tests done. And what the tests show, some areas were more affected than the other areas within even my local town. And the water was contaminated and the soil was contaminated also.
Have you noticed irregularities like Mary Osborne noticed in the Three Mile Island area after the exposure there? Are there changes in plants, animals, things like that?
Yes, there are even now. There were lots of changes, mutations in animals. There were calves born with the two heads, and there were rabbits with the couple legs. And also there were kids. Kids were born also with a couple extra fingers, or the same goes for the flowers, for the daisies. Exactly the same thing was happening in Belarus. It is still happening.
That was Natalie Kilich, a survivor of the Chernobyl accident that took place 19 years ago this month. Kilich says that right after the accident, there was an outpouring of help to her country, and the government of Belarus sent funds that the locals called coffin money. But since the breakup of the Soviet Union, Belarus has struggled on its own. We're coming to you from the trenches. Last Friday, Students for Justice in Palestine handed out flyers and protested outside a jobs fair in the Student Center at the University of Illinois in Chicago.
My name's Seba, and we're protesting the fact that there's military recruiters and like weapons manufacturers at our job fair.
The Northrop Grumman is there, the FBI, the U.S. military, and Caterpillar was supposed to be here, but we think they got frightened because the other day out on campus here we had giant signs showing how Caterpillar really builds weapons of mass destruction against the Palestinians.
And what is your name?
Betty.
Have you been able to go into the job fair?
I don't think we've done that yet, but we plan to go in and offer people flyers, the people that are going to apply for jobs, we're going to offer them flyers at the table and say to them, read this, this is the other side, reconsider going up to this job.
What do your flyers say?
Well, it basically tells information about each one of the war recruiters that are up there. And it also has a little advertisement for a film we're showing next week called Military Myths.
Oh, tell me about the film.
It's called Military Myths, and it features interviews with youth activists and other people and stuff.
It's particularly good on how the military mistreats lesbians and gays. So we have interviews on that film from people who have actually experienced the harsh treatment from the military. So it's a very lively film and very persuasive for youth because it's done in a kind of hip-hop style, would you say?
Oh, it's a great movie. Not only does it tell about from the perspective of young veterans, it also shows, you know, how they dehumanize people who go into the military. And, you know, no wonder they say, oh, the military is great. Even people who've been in that horrible situation, they want to rationalize it in their mind. They've lost some of their humanity. And so we want to protect those people, too, even though they've lost something. You know, they can regain it.
What is your name?
Suzanne.
A lot of the people that Suzanne was describing say that when they went into the military, they didn't understand what they were getting into. And many of them were motivated by earning money for college. So one of the flyers, another flyer that we're handing out, has all these lies that the military tells people about how they can get money for education. So we try to show that these myths are full of hot air.
Eric Peters, also with Students for Justice in Palestine, says that the protest this year at the jobs fair may be confined to the lobby.
Well, in the past, we've gone inside, not to necessarily protest, but we've sent people like up to the different booths, the weapons contractors, the recruiters, basically to challenge them, put them on the spot, ask them about some of the ethics and morality involved in the work they're doing and so forth. But last fall, we went to the job fair, and some of the military recruiters, along with the Caterpillar recruiters, got really bent out of shape when we started to ask them questions about human rights and stuff, and they created this huge scene in which they were just like yelling and screaming and calling for us to be removed, and that caused some students to go running out of the place saying, there's a riot taking place. I mean, it was crazy, you know, but... So this time around, they're telling us that if you don't have a resume and you're not dressed nice, that you can't go on the job fair. You know, it's just another measure to try and limit our ability to get into it. But that's okay, because instead we're out here still talking to people. It's pretty clear who's going to the job fair. Most people are dressed nice. So those are the people we're definitely seeking out to talk to as we see them walking. And just ask them to at least consider, you know, balance the fact that they need a job against what those jobs might entail them actually having to do.
How effective do you think this kind of outreach is?
Well, I mean, it depends how you measure effectiveness, I guess. In terms of, like, for instance, the people who put on the job fair and stuff like that, we've actually had some discussions with them. Well, here's the thing. The director actually doesn't like hosting weapons contractors and military recruiters, but he's not in a position in which he can make that decision, you know. It's a job fair. Anyone that has a job to offer is allowed to come, essentially. Provided they pay it's like a $500 tabling fee or something like that. But they have expressed to us at least that they appreciate what we're doing because they support it. And also, they've told us that if we want to work with them on having some kind of peace and justice job fair, they would do that. They did something like that, I think it was Loyola, maybe DePaul, in which they had a peace and justice or maybe careers and social justice job fair and brought in, you know, NGOs and human rights groups, stuff like that, not-for-profits. So we may try to do something like that in the fall, perhaps.
What
Protesting no jobs for war. Protesting no jobs for war.
Again, this coming Thursday at 3:30 p.m., Students for Justice in Palestine will show the film Military Myths at the African American Cultural Center, room 207, Adams Hall. Also on Thursday, as well as today, you can see films about Palestine at the Gene Siskel Film Center. This year's Palestine Film Festival has been in full swing for over a week and moves to Xavier University after Thursday for the final week of showings. Dwan Kaoukji is media coordinator for the Palestine Film Festival. She likes the fact that although all the films are about Palestine, they're not all produced by Palestinian filmmakers.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a different perspective. And actually, I think that's what's refreshing about it. You have, you have Europeans' perspective is extremely different from the Palestinian one, which is extremely different from the American one as well. And I think that's what makes it so interesting, because you have all these different eyes looking at the issue.
A change in the festival schedule serves as a reminder of the continuing conflict in Palestine. Shadi Swaro will not be visiting the festival as planned because he was not able to obtain a visa to enter the U.S. For more information about the schedule of the Palestine Film Fest, you can go to the Reader or PalestineFilmFest.com. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Hi, freeze! Police!
Bad.
Cop. Donut.
Bad. 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 Bad.
Cop. 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 Cop.
No. 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 No.
Donut, 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 donut. It's under law, and I rule.
One of the most popular shows posted on radio.indymedia.org is produced by a community radio station volunteer in Canada.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto.
Bad Cop, No Donut doesn't have a set length. It can run from 20 minutes to an hour and 20 minutes. As long as its creator, Ron Anisich, thinks it needs to be. Anisich says the show grew out of a segment on his regular weekly call-in show.
I've been doing a show at CKLN for about 15 years, and there was a segment called Bad Cop, No Donut that we started doing about, 5 years ago, or maybe a little longer even. It essentially consisted of me coming across things occasionally and ranting, a couple stories a week, and then ranting on about them for an hour, and people would call. It was a live segment. And I guess at some point, last summer, I got the idea that I wanted to really focus that part of the show. Here in Toronto, we have some serious issues with our police department right now. And the more I read about it, the more I saw connections to things that were happening in other places. So the idea became to connect all of these different incidents of police brutality and misconduct. Police abuse, generally, is the word I use to describe it, from across North America in as thorough a way as possible, for two reasons. One, to document the incredible amount of stuff that goes on every week, and the second part would be to make connections between things that happen in different places. For instance, every year our chief of police in Toronto does this dance in front of the media where he talks about how bad crime is, despite the fact that crime rates have been going down for the last 20 consecutive years, in order to increase the police budget. I've read subsequently to learning that about police chiefs all over North America who do this exact same thing. This is one of many examples.
Tasers. But first, let's have a look at what the police did to us this week. A man is dead after a confrontation with Toronto police officers. According to a City TV report, the man was pronounced dead at a nearby hospital after police were called in to deal with a man running after streetcars and yelling. No other details are available. A police officer in Montreal, Quebec, who is on trial this week for shoplifting, is having some difficulty explaining his actions. According to a Canadian press article, Officer Guy Marlowe stole $200 worth of diapers, steaks, and Coca-Cola from a supermarket in April 2002. The officer claimed he was just trying to show the store manager how easy it was to steal from the store. According to testimony from
police in Columbus, Georgia, killed a man this week, apparently by shooting him with supposedly non-lethal beanbag projectiles. According to the Associated Press, the man died in hospital 2 days after the incident when he was shot with two of the beanbag bullets. He was.
You must spend a lot of time doing research, getting all these articles together. Where do you look?
Well, there's a number of ways I get stuff for the show. People do send me stuff. I do look. I search news-related websites for stories about police misconduct or police abuse. It's not that hard. There's certainly a lot of stuff out there. I suspect that there's a lot of stuff that I don't find out about. Frequently, I'm sent things by listeners that I wasn't able to find on my own. You know, keyword searches are only so effective.
Mm-hmm. What's the range of crimes that you find that or misconduct that police are involved in?
Boy, you know, it seems to be ever expanding. It really depends on more on them than me. I generally try to stick to cases where laws are broken or where there's an obvious question of conduct, like, excessive use of force.
Do any particular crimes come to mind that seem to be astonishing that police are involved in?
Well, yeah, lots. I'm astonished every week. There seems to be, there are a lot of crimes that the police commit that do not get reported, and they are crimes that certain studies have indicated are massive problems within policing. One I can think of off the top of my head is domestic abuse.
A police officer in Rodell, West Virginia, has been arrested on charges of domestic battery and brandishing a weapon. The Associated Press says that Officer Daniel Ray Price has already been released on a $100,000 bond.
There are two North American studies that say that approximately 40% of police officers are domestic abusers. That's, to me, an incredible number. But the research seems sound, so... clearly, domestic abuse is rampant. I've been alarmed in the past couple months about how many police officers have sexually violated children. It seems like every week I can come up with a couple stories. You know, whether it's child pornography or direct sexual abuse in some cases. Like, to me, that's horrible.
Former Newbury, Massachusetts police officer has been found guilty of raping a young girl and has been sentenced to between 7 and 9 years in jail. A report from WCVB says that Officer Gary Clifford was found guilty by a jury on two counts of rape of a child.
There's a guy in Isle of Wight, Virginia, this week who sexually assaulted a 10-year-old girl, and I think that the people who live there are probably thinking they have the only cop in America who does something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. I mean, I think every week for the past month or so, I've been able to come up with at least two stories that are very similar to that.
Whenever you see bad cops on TV, they're usually involved in drugs, and that's usually the only thing you see.
Yeah, cops do definitely deal drugs, steal drugs from evidence lockers. It seems to me that there's an ability for the police to commit a crime or where an opportunity exists, it's usually exploited. And oddly enough, I'm reading this book called Our Enemies in Blue by Christian Williams. And this person... documents these kinds of abuses going back to the dawn of modern policing. basically making a strong case that where there have been opportunities for authority, police authority specifically, to be abused, it has been.
This is not the way we do business in Kansas City. If people have issues with this police department, they should step up and step up strongly.
Last week, a police officer in Kansas City, Missouri, was charged with stealing money from a motorist after a sting was set up to catch him in the act. An Associated Press account of the story says that Officer Mershon Pope was arrested last week and charged with misconduct in administration of office. Last week, Pope was left alone with an undercover officer who was posing as a Latino driver with a poor command of the English language. The sting revealed that the officer stole money from inside the victim's car and inside the man's wallet. The car and wallet contained marked bills that were later recovered at the officer's home. Pope was suspended.
You find cops, dealing drugs and selling drugs and stealing drugs and money, and they do pretty much what they can do.
Now, you have a separate segment of your program that's just about taser incidents.
Next up, a review of this week's taser news.
It was the worst experience I have ever had in my life. I don't want to see anybody ever go through anything like that.
He's my friend, and seeing him there, like, on the ground screaming like that, just...
I don't remember anything. I just have dreams about it every now and then.
He couldn't understand why they were treating him this way, because he hadn't been drinking, he hadn't been doing anything, and he wasn't hurting anybody.
Obviously, it raises a question of lack of training. It raises a bigger question of lack of judgment.
And then all these copper wires that were coming off his back, I had no clue what they were.
The wife of a man who died after being shot with a taser twice by police in Washington in February 2004 has filed a claim against Kitsap County, accusing them of improper use of a taser.
It started off with, I guess I just kind of noticed that there are a lot of allegations of brutality were the result of questionable use of these tasers. And I didn't report them all together at first. I didn't really make the connection. But the more I guess eventually there were so many of them that I started kind of grouping them together. And lately there's been all kinds of, there have been all kinds of activists and scientists and even police agencies that are calling tasers into question. I think it's important to be dealing with that. A lot of the stories I realize aren't really directly related to the, you know, police abuse on the show. So I've actually questioned why I've been doing this as well. But I mean, it's valid from the point of view of these things kill people, and people have to know about it.
A coroner in San Mateo County, California, has determined that a stun gun was a factor in the death of a man in Pacifica in January. The victim died in hospital hours after being shot by police with a stun gun. Police in Putnam County, Florida, used tasers on high school students twice this week to break up fights. A police officer in Berwyn, Illinois, used a stun gun on a 17-year-old high school student at school this week. The stun gun was used after the police officer and a school security guard had difficulty forcing the student into the principal's office. After being shot with the taser, the student suffered a seizure and was taken to hospital in an ambulance. A police officer in Newark, New Jersey, used a taser on a 15-year-old who had been involved in a schoolyard fight this week. The student was arrested and charged with assaulting a police officer. A test run of 14 tasers by the Milwaukee Police Department has ended with the decision to shelve the weapons until data gathered about their usefulness can be evaluated. During the one-year pilot project, 52 Milwaukee police officers used tasers 262 times. A man in Indianapolis, Indiana, died last Thursday after being shot with a police taser. A man in Lake City, Florida, died last Friday after being shot by a police taser. Two state senators in Florida are calling for a statewide ban on taser use until their effects can be studied thoroughly. They point to 18 Florida deaths of people who had been shocked by one of the devices.
There are many police departments and representatives of Taser International, the company that makes the weapons, that are going around saying that they don't kill people, they don't cause heart attacks, and they And the science behind this is faulty or questionable at best, depending on who you ask. So I guess the segment is evolved as people's as the knowledge of what these weapons are all about has grown.
Mm-hmm. You had the fellow on your last program, James Ruggieri.
Yeah.
He's an engineer.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an engineer. He's done a lot of research, actually, and he gave a pretty important presentation last month to an academy. I think it was the American Academy of Forensic Science. And part of the problem with tasers is that coroners have been unwilling to say that tasers have been the a cause of death or even a contributing factor because of some pretty poor research and widely held fallacies, according to Mr. Ruggieri, at least. So his work is important, I think, primarily for that reason. He's enlightening people who make these determinations, and if the people who are now the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States is looking at Taser right now, and a branch of the Arizona government for making false claims about their products, specifically that they don't cause deaths. When coroners start saying, as they did in California last week, that that tasers are in fact a contributing cause in people's deaths, then it kind of blows tasers' claims out of the law. Well, not kind of, it does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it shows very clearly that the company is lying in its advertising material, it's making false representations about its products. And Mr. Ruggieri also points out that there are 25 lawsuits in the United States against Taser International right now alleging precisely this, among mm-hmm. other things.
Have you ever been able to interview anybody at Taser?
I wrote somebody a letter, and I emailed somebody from the company the other day, a guy named Tuttle, which is, have you seen Brazil? Anyway, they never got back to me. I'm sure they have bigger problems to deal with, bigger fires to put out than some, community radio guy from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, our police services board a couple weeks ago approved the purchase of new tasers for the Toronto police. So I guess they don't see me doing any damage. So what? I'm assuming that's their thinking. I don't know.
This is hate mongering.
Ryerson University has come under pressure from the city's police chief to ban a program on its campus radio station that airs negative stories about the cops.
In quotes, the police chief there in Toronto, Julian Fantino, "I am disgusted that this kind of hate mongering would be directed at our police officers." So the chief wants something done.
Now, you've come under fire recently for your program by the Toronto police.
Yeah.
Tell me about this.
Well, I'm not really sure what happened. What I do know is that the former chief of police, on his last week on the job, decided that in front of a TV crew, he was going to call me a hate mongerer. I guess he thinks the police are one of the groups that are protected under the charter. You know, hate crimes are, something that we take really seriously, especially at CKLN. Most of the communities that we represent or that are represented at CKLN are, often the victims of the exact type of hate that the police chief is accusing us of being mongerers of. Well, anyway, I checked the Human Rights Code and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the two pertinent documents when it comes to hate, and it turns out that the police aren't on it anywhere. Not a surprise. And the Charter of Rights spells it out very clearly. You cannot discriminate on the basis of race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, etc., etc. occupation isn't even on the list, you know, and it shouldn't be. So I guess at the end of the day, the chief just did me this huge favor. Like, I can't see it any other way. I got to occasionally talk about police abuse issues with a much larger number of people than I had been up till that point.
You were in the mainstream media.
Oh, yeah. For it's actually, this was a month ago, and it's continued right up. It's still going on.
The show is called Bad Cop, No Donut.
Program called Bad Cop, No Donut, which Chief Fantino has pressured Ryerson to ban.
Bad Cop, No Donut.
He considered their programming hate-mongering, particularly the show Bad Cop, No Donut.
Radio program on CKLN that caught the attention of Chief Fantino in not a positive way.
Just a litany of anti-cop stories gleaned from papers and press reports across North America.
A Canadian talk show host, the police want to see silenced.
Is he peddling hate or just a misguided radio host?
Why don't you tell us what the email address is?
IHatePigs@hotmail.com.
IHatePigs.com.
I mean, you've given up the email address, but it was IHatePigs.com. IHatePigs@hotmail.com. This is a cop-hating audience, or they wouldn't respond to an email address like that. But why not mix the I Hate Pigs stories with the this is the way in which I was served and protected?
It's pretty one-sided then, wouldn't you say?
Obviously, you're not there to praise the work of the police departments around North America.
They were accusing you of being unfair, that it wasn't a balanced show because you weren't showing the good things that cops do. What's your response to that?
My response to that is I assume that they're writing the New York Times about the number of living people that aren't found on their obituaries page. Look, the show is about police abuse, just like the obituaries are about dead people. You don't write to the editor of the obituaries page and tell him that he's not being fair and balanced because he's not writing about people that are alive. I think that argument holds no water whatsoever. Also, the police are treated generally fairly and positively by the mainstream media. And I, as I mentioned earlier, work at a place where we are giving a voice to views and people that are not heard in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would suggest that many of the same people who are calling me unfair and unbalanced are exactly that themselves. The attention that's been directed at my show by the media has been... I have a lot of mixed feelings about the whole... about what's happened. I was very happy up until that point. Like, I wasn't going out and looking for publicity for the show. I just wanted to do my show, you know?
Well, has it changed what you put on your show?
I attribute stories a little better than I was before, because I want to really drive home the point that I'm not, one, not making this stuff up, and two, that I'm not doing anything, that I'm not telling anyone anything that hasn't already been reported. And I also changed the email address for the show. I had a kind of a flippant email address that I really hadn't given any thought to whatsoever before, but was actually quite offensive to people, it turned out. So I changed that.
The new email address for Ron Anisich, host of Bad Cop, No Donut, is ron@ckln.fm.
It's under law, and I rule.
From the Trenches was produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center with help from Loyola University. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, or find news and information from Chicago or around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Many thanks to WLUW for their continued support. Listen again on the fourth Monday in May for another report from the Trenches.